This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We are tonight's entertainment.
Hello.
Why don't you want to talk to me?
Who is this?
You tell me your name, I'll tell you mine.
I don't think so.
I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Get away from her, you bitch.
And why do you want to kill me?
I don't want to kill you.
Here's Johnny.
The show is mine.
They're back.
Indeed we are. This is the Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie. How are you going, Kylie?
Very well, thank you. I thought that was going to be a trick question then. I'm good. Just waking up, obviously.
Yeah, well, you've spent all the morning seeing films in preparation for the show.
I have had a very intensive couple of days of watching tons of movies. I shouldn't really be complaining.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not, as gigs go, it's not a bad one.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good life.
Now, we've got Alan Tuxford once more on panelling. He also produces the show you're about to listen to. Big thank you to Murray for looking after the news, and cheers to Hugh and Mark for covering for Kaz on The Women's Zone. That was, I don't think we've had a couple of blokes doing that feel for a long time.
You know what? It's not bad to have a bit of testosterone mixed with the progesterone. I can't even say it.
What are these days?
Estrogen?
That's probably it.
That's easier to say.
Yeah, we may even get testosterone on this show one day as well.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
Now, despite the fact that you and I, Kylie, have been seeing quite a few films, it's a bit slim pickings at the moment, isn't it? There's not a huge amount out there.
No, there's a couple of major releases that came out this week, but that's it. So we will be covering those. Hot Tub Time Machine. Mm-hmm. And I also went and saw When in Rome.
Yeah, they're the two biggies. And I'm going to be also talking on the show about Beneath Hill 60. This is a new Australian war film that opened last week, but it's still playing, you know, in a lot of places, so it still will be very relevant. Now, we've got quite a literary, I suppose, second hour of the show. We're going to be interviewing two writers. Now, the first person we're going to speak to is Brian Carby. He is the screenwriter of Accidents Happen. Now, this is the new Australian film starring Gina Davis.
And it's fantastic, even though, you know, we say Australian film, and for all intents and purposes, it is. It was shot here, it was financed here, all the actors by Gina are Australian, except it's set in America.
Yeah, in the 1980s. 1980s America in Connecticut.
Yeah, so obviously...
Shot in Sydney last year.
There are some places in Sydney that haven't changed since the 80s. So, I mean, they've done a remarkable job. The production design team have done an amazing job transforming Sydney suburbs to look like the US in the 80s.
It's going to be an interesting interview because Brian Carby is a performer himself, and I believe the character that Gina Davis plays is based on his own mother, and he actually originally played that part himself in drag on stage at various cabaret performances.
There's just so much therapy that sounds like that is required.
I suspect there's a bit of that. So,
well, maybe that's a part of being on the stage.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm really intrigued to find out more about that. And also the incredible homosexual subtext in this film.
It was electric. And all the way through the film, I'm like, what? And then nothing.
So, yeah, we're going to grill him about that. What exactly happened? Now, a big festival at the moment in Melbourne is the Festival of German Films.
Yes, it just started yesterday, or was it the day before?
Probably Thursday, I think it started.
Now, it is actually travelling all over. It's all playing across the country.
Yep.
So, you know, if you're listening to us on joy.org.au in other states, it will be coming to your fair town as well. But we're delighted to have on the show the author of Ami and Jaguar. Now, for any self-respecting lesbian out there in our whole audience, they will know this film. It was it came out in 1999, and it's set in World War II about an illicit love affair between two women, one of whom is Jewish and working for the resistance, and one who is obviously a Nazi supporter.
Yeah.
So, and it's based on the novel by the same name by Erica Fisher, and she's over here as part of the festival. She'll be attending some of the screenings of this film. So they're doing a viewing of Ami and Jaguar on the big screen. So we're going to have a chat to her about what it's like translating her novel into a script.
Yeah, it's a big deal. So
yeah, it's amazing. And this film has been so successful for so long. It is certainly a seminal lesbian film. So we're delighted to have her on the show today.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to both our interviews. Now, feel free to contact us throughout the show. We love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of some films you've seen lately. You can call us on 1-300-JOY-949. You can SMS us on 0427-JOY-949. Or there's always the email onair@joy.org.au. In fact, stick with the SMS and emails today. We don't have our front desk support person, so it'd be a lot easier if we can just deal with your correspondence within the studio.
Why can't you just run out?
Or I can run out.
You could just run out and just pick up the phone in between, because I know how good you are at multi-skilling.
Yeah.
And maybe if people want to come to the Joy studio, and they can just buzz and you can run downstairs and let them in. And
I'll go downstairs. I'll have a chat. I'll find out what it is you want to say, and I'll bring it back up.
Yeah. Perfect. I love it.
It'll be good. Now, while I'm doing that, Kylie, you're going to look after the music. We've got we're going to be reviewing Hot Tub Time Machine, where a bunch of blokes go back to the 80s, and we're going to be talking to Brian Carby about his film Accidents Happen, which is set in the 80s. So we thought, hang on a second, we have a pattern here.
There's a theme. Let's play music from the 90s. No, we're actually playing music from the 80s.
And you're looking after the music, which excites me a lot.
Well, I know. Having full responsibility of the music, but you know, I'll give it my best shot.
It's been successful so far.
Oh, you're too kind. I don't know if anyone else agrees with you. I agree with you, because obviously it's my music.
What are we going to start with?
We're going to start with, there's so much to choose from in Hot Tub Time Machine. Yeah. And the music is actually one of the funnest parts of it. And there is a rendition of Jesse's Girl, Rick Springfield, which is a fantastic. And this is one of my all-time 80s favourite songs. So let's kick off with Jesse's Girl by Rick Springfield on the Casting Couch. You're with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9. This is The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9, and that is Our Lips Are Sealed, The Go-Go's, and I have to admit that I have stolen ruthlessly from the Romeo Michelle's High School Reunion soundtrack, because it is so killer.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that.
It is so good. If we're going to go 80s and films that are partially set in 80s and have 80s flashbacks, you can't go past the original Romeo Michelle's. I'm not saying that number two is any good. Yeah, there's a sequel.
Really?
Yeah, direct to video.
Different actors.
Yeah. Because they couldn't get the other ones became famous.
I had no idea.
You know, they won an Academy Award and, I don't know, had a long-running TV show or something to do.
Yeah.
So there'll be plenty of that coming up, 80s music.
Romy and Michelle, great. Romy and Michelle is one of those films that was proudly a little bit dumb, but in the sense that it was, in fact, a very clever film.
Do you
know what I mean?
It kind of set itself up
to be a bit... The humour was meant to be a bit kind of silly and dorky, but it was actually quite a cleverly structured film and a little bit surreal.
Yeah, and really funny.
Yeah.
It's a little bit like Legally Blonde in that the heroes or the heroine, you know, they start out and you think, oh, they're never going to cut. They're just stupid. And yet by some strange twist of fate, they manage to work it all out.
Yeah. But what I'm trying to segue into is this idea of a film that is proudly stupid and it wears it on its sleeve and tries to be something a bit cleverer. Such as Hot Tub Time Machine.
Nice segue.
Yeah.
We got there in the end. You should have given me a heads up.
Sorry, I did think of that just off the cuff there. But, I mean, I think that's sort of what's happening. I mean, the title alone pretty much informs you that this isn't going to be Citizen Kane meets Hamlet. You know, it's
fairly ironic in its delivery.
Yeah, I mean, the premise is you've got four guys who travel from present day to 1986 via a ski lodge hot tub. That's a jacuzzi in Australia. And that's the premise. That is it. Four guys go back in time. Three of them are actually alive at the time, and so they revert back to their younger selves. Well, the other one is a kid now, and so he's just... they all just shrug their shoulders and go, We don't know.
We don't know what we're going to do with you. You don't exist yet.
Yeah, you're just a character who's here because you're funny.
Yeah, it's the premise. I mean, you have to... Obviously, what I quite like about it is with these kind of films that have some kind of twist and conceit, it's great where you get that out of the way up front. And there is a part where Craig Robinson, who plays one of the lead characters, and he, for my money, was the funniest guy in the crew.
I love Craig Robinson.
Oh, he's so great.
Just so people know who he is, he was in Zack and Miri Make a Porno. And
love
he's
it.
A regular in the US version of The Office. He plays Daryl, the warehouse manager of... he's a really big, tall, imposing American-African actor. He was also in 40-Year-Old Virgin. He played the bouncer.
Well, he's played quite a few little cameo roles, but he's really coming to the fore now and getting more lead roles, and well-deservedly. And he does do a bit of a, direct-to-the-camera kind of, it must be some kind of hot tub time machine.
Yeah.
Deadpan, crickets. And you go, okay, we know where we're at. And actually, apparently, Craig Robinson also came up with the Michael Jackson joke that's used in the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So part of how they discover they're back in the 80s, as if the leg warmers and the fluoro colours and someone with a cassette Walkman weren't enough, is that he asks...
What
colour is Michael Jackson? And she says black. And he's like, and he runs out in horror. So, you know, I'm not giving anything away. That's in the trailer.
Yeah. See, all that I really liked. The start of this film, I really enjoyed the whole kind of dorky kind of frat boy humour almost vibe to this film and just how silly it is. The culture referencing outdoes The Wedding Singer. I think, just that kind of reveling in 80s cliches is really, really fun. And you've got when Crispin Glover, of course, who was the McFly, the dad from Back to the Future, when he first appears on screen, it's a delight. When Chevy Chase first appears on screen, it's like, yes.
Yes.
But I'll tell you what, my problem with this film, and it's similar actually to why I disliked Date Night, is which I know you liked a lot more than I did.
Yeah,
It's a film that they've got all the great actors in there.
Yeah.
They've got a great premise. It just, the laughs didn't come through enough for me. I got a bit sick of it.
I have to admit that, the first part was pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And then the middle part, I was really wanting it to deliver on the 80s stuff.
Yep.
And sure, there was a lot in there, but they're just wasn't enough for me. It didn't deliver on the premise. We're going back to the 80s and this is what it's going to be like. The other thing that kind of creeped me out a little bit is obviously John Cusack is in it, who is a seminal actor from the 80s.
Mm.
I mean, and a lot of that kind of hurts your brain a little bit. There are some moments where it's very 16 Candles, except part of the conceit of this idea is that when they're back in the 80s, on screen, they're like their 40-year-old selves.
Yeah.
So we see John Cusack as he is now.
Yeah.
But the people who are in the 80s view them as their younger selves. So when they look in the reflection in the mirror, they look young.
We do see that.
So we see that everyone else is viewing them as young, but we're seeing them as old. So when they're making out, and all of them do, all of them kiss teenage girls, it's really... Well, there's a lot more. And when you see that, it kind of creeped me out a little bit because... I know that the girls think they're teenage boys, or they might be in their early 20s. Regardless, it was just creepy and weird.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I love John Cusack, but I'm sick of him playing sad sack characters. I mean, he's yet another kind of guy who's just been left by his girlfriend, who's all depressed and miserable. I'm thinking, hang on, he did this in 2012. He's been doing this since High Fidelity, really.
Yeah, I mean, at least High Fidelity, that was an amazing film.
Written by the director of Hot Tub Time Machine.
Well, actually, Steve Pink, who directed this, and it's kind of like his big screen directorial debut. They've actually been friends since high school.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so John Cusack and Steve Pink, and there's another one other of their best friends mm-hmm. who also co-wrote High Fidelity. They've all been mates since high school, and they formed their own production company together. They were also responsible for Gross Point Blank, which is another one of my favourite Cusack films.
Another good 80s film too, actually.
Great 80s
film. It's not set in the 80s, but all the characters talk about it and play lots of 80s music. It's
so
a great film.
It's a great film. So, you know, they do have Steve Pink does look, you know, it did feel a little bit nepotistic for my taste.
I think it tried a bit too hard to cram a lot of ideas in, which means I didn't really develop anything. And I also got sick of the slightly homophobic and sexist tone of the humour. I mean, it wasn't just that the characters were like that, which can work sometimes because you laugh at them or they can be shocking. But I think the audience is meant to laugh along at the gay jokes as well.
Didn't quite work
and
for
I
me.
And I just thought, oh, come on, 2010, let's just
well,
get rid of this
of
kind
of thing.
Part of
that is that they're supposed to have a sensibility from 2010 and take that back to the 80s, but I didn't really feel any of that clash between sensibility of now and then. So those jokes didn't kind of work. Can I also say I saw this on Thursday during the day, and I was alert. Well, I wasn't alone in the cinema. There were like six other dudes, about 40 by themselves. I'm like, this is the target market. This is, they're going to love it.
What are you going to give it out of 5?
You know, I hadn't really thought about that. What are you going to give it?
I'm going to give it 2.5 stars.
You know what? I liked it slightly. I really wanted to like it. Mm. Yeah, I'm going to give it 2.
2.
2. Yeah, it didn't really deliver for me.
Yeah. Hot Tub Time Machine. It's playing everywhere. Kylie, what are we going to listen to now?
Well, I thought that look, this track is not in the film. Duran Duran, a classic 80s band. This song is Girls on Film, but it's not actually the Duran Duran version. It's actually a cover by The Living End. There was an album called Undone, Songs of the Duran Duran, where Australian artists covered a whole range of Duran Duran songs, so I thought I'd mix it up. And I would just say that this music video of Girls on Film, the original from the 80s, I'm pretty sure this music video, I don't know if you can remember it, it was kind of had girls on with doing pillow fights in negligees. Pretty sure it turned me into a lesbian.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, this is one of my favourite tracks of all time. You're listening to The Casting Couch on with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to The Casting Couch. You're with Thomas and Kylie here on Joy 94.9. Now, we've had a bit of correspondence since we began the show. I thought I would take this moment to read out now.
Since we began the show in...
Today. Like, yeah, not...
not 100 years ago.
Not back when Mark Pace first started it, you know.
Oh, we finally got an email.
Yeah, like, yes! Yeah, all this just big today. Backlog of mail just got dumped on the studio door. Now, I don't know who wrote this, but they've just written to tell us, I always love a good horror. I recently watched The Exorcism of Emily Rose, thumbs down. I have heard that's not such a great film. And then our mysterious SMSer has also said they've seen recently Lost Souls with Winona Ryder.
I quite like Lost Souls, actually.
Yeah, well, they're saying it's great. Apparently it flopped, but this listener is giving it the thumbs up.
Yeah,
I must check it out.
Yes.
Now, you spoke before about how Duran Duran video clips made you a lesbian, Kylie. Yes. Ryan has said...
Well, just one specific Duran Duran.
Yeah.
Anyway, girls on film.
Ryan has SMS'd us to say, I think Nightmare on Elm Street 2 made me gay, so there you go. I love that he wrote it, so there you go.
Yeah, so there you go. Can't explain it. Well, you know that they are doing a remake of Nightmare on Elm Street. It's just starting again. They're just calling it Nightmare on Elm Street. So, Ryan, your gay fantasy is about to be realised again.
Yeah, feel free to send in more details, Ryan, about exactly what it was. There were shower scenes, I think.
Eddie Kruger's got those sexy knife fingers.
I'm sure it had nothing to do with Eddie Kruger. Now, lovely email from a chap called Lloyd who says that he listens to us almost every week and he enjoys it and tells us to keep
What are you doing the other
the
weeks,
work.
Lloyd?
Almost every week. He says nearly every week. Don't hold him to task on that. He has a quick question for us. He's talking about a new film called Harry Brown. This is a new Michael Caine film. It's been described as a bit like a Cockney version of Gran Torino. Old guy in a housing estate cuts loose and all the shavs, you know, causing hell in the apartment. I think they kill his best friend and he gets revenge. It's being advertised as being released April 22nd, but that's not that's not on anywhere. Yeah, Lloyd, I don't know what you've seen. Sometimes when they move the dates around, it doesn't always get updated properly in the right sources. The latest information I have is Harry Brown is getting a release in Australia on May the 27th.
A month of... Pushed it back a month.
Yep, and I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about it on the show because I'm quite excited and interested in seeing it. Michael Caine kicks ass. I can't wait to see him go to task on the Shams.
I'm a Clint Eastwood.
It's not like one or the other.
Either or.
It's not either or.
Oh, I don't think he can compete. I don't know.
No. I love Clint as well, but Michael Caine is... What's wrong with Michael Caine?
Don't have a conniption.
Yeah, I am. I'll tell you what, I'm going to let you do this review and I'm just going to go and chill out. Because obviously I'm in a mood for no real reason.
I'm just stirring you up. I'm having a great time.
You are. You do it so effectively.
I know.
Curse you, Eddie.
So I have had a comedy fest this week. Mm-hmm. I went and saw When in Rome. It is a big released rom-com. It just came out on Thursday. And so I took myself along, and as I just said in the last segment about Hot Tub Time Machine, I saw a daytime session with 5 40-year-old dudes. Well, and I'm like, that is the right target market for this film. Then I went across the hall and went and saw When in Rome, and there are a couple of grannies and a mum. Mm. So I felt like, it's kind of the target market for this film as well.
Okay.
It's a romantic comedy about Beth, who is a young, ambitious New Yorker who is completely unlucky in love. However, on a whirlwind trip to Rome, poor thing. Oh, yeah. She's got a great job and she has to go to Rome. She impulsively steals some coins from a reputed fountain of love. And what happens is when you steal the coins, apparently the people who threw the coins in then fall in love with you. So then she's pursued... by these 5 coin throwing, tossing, exactly, suitors back to New York.
Sounds like a decent premise.
You know what? Look, it's not bad. As far as rom-coms go, I mean, it's a little slightly on the mystical kind of side of things. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's kind of like the Hot Tub Time Machine for rom-coms. and, you know, I don't mind that so much, but it does... And once again, this film just didn't really live up to its promise for me. Mm. It's directed by Mark Steven Johnson, who comes from a comic book kind of background.
He's made horrible films
like
in the past.
Like Ghost Rider.
Oh, yeah, and Daredevil.
And Daredevil. Oh, how can you get Daredevil wrong, for Pete's sake? Yeah. So he kind of comes from this very blokey, action-y...
But there are even films that blokey action fans don't like, though.
Yeah, and he just, I don't think that relationships are really his key kind of understandings.
What, somebody obsessed with superheroes isn't that good at relationships?
Well, no, I actually think superheroes are all about relationships and they're very important.
I'm talking about the people who like superhero
texts. Oh, yeah, maybe them. Yeah.
So okay. I'm being rude again. I'm being horrible. Sorry, comic book readers. I am actually one of you, so I'll stop.
I was standing up for the comic book readers. So, and it's also written by 2 blokes, and it just feels a little bit... you know what, from a female's perspective, I just don't really think they nailed the female characters.
Mm-hmm.
It does star Kristen Bell.
Who I love.
Who is the best thing in it.
Yeah.
She is great. Yep. She is funny. She is. She was in Forgetting Sarah Marshall. She's Sarah Marshall.
Yep. She was Veronica Mars.
She was Veronica Mars, and apparently there is still rumoured to be a feature film being made of Veronica Mars, so let's fingers crossed. And she's also in this fantastic series that if you can get your whole hands on it, it's called Party Down. It's an American sitcom. It is hilarious. It's great. If you know how to use the internet-y downloading machine-y thing.
Not that we advocate that.
Not at all. But if someone happened to know how to do that, I heartily recommend Party Down if you can get your hands on it.
Okay.
And she's a fantastic actress, and she actually does have some chemistry with the romantic lead, Dosh Shamel, who is actually best known for his lead role in the TV series Las Vegas. He's kind of a very schwammy, kind of charismatic young guy, and he has been in a couple of really terrible films, and I think he's been grouped as like the leading man. So they do actually have chemistry, and their relationship is quite good. The idea being is that she thinks it's very predictable. Like, he's one of the guys that, you know, is the coins, but she kind of liked him, and he kind of liked her before she took the coins out, so she's not sure if he's just under the spell or not.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of supporting cast who are... so insanely underused and embarrassingly so. Like, you know, John Heder from Napoleon Dynamite is just, oh, it's so embarrassing. I feel for him. And Will Arnett as well, who, oh, you know, so there's some great comedic actors in there who just, I don't know, it's kind of embarrassing.
Can you give it a score out of 5?
I can give it a score out of 5. I don't really want to. You know what? I'm feeling so tough this week.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it a 1.5.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah, just, you know, I love my rom-coms.
Yeah, you do.
And I really do love, but it just, something did not connect.
Well, it sounds like they've wasted a lot of really good talent. And that's very annoying.
Yeah, and look at,
and I hope Kirsten Bell doesn't go the way of the ditzy starlet.
I hope not. Look, this middle section of the film where she's kind of being pursued is quite good fun.
Yeah.
And if you can kind of get over the lame kind of premise, you know, it's okay. Oh, maybe it's a 2. No, I'm going to stick with 1.5.
All right, 1.5. 1¾ stars. Entirely.
can we do 1¾?
Yeah. No. For when in Rome. Okay, let's listen to some music to perk us all up. What have you got for us?
Well, I'm feeling like you just can't get away from fame at the moment, so...
I guess you're talking about the music or not, the David Bowie song.
Yes, I am. So I thought that we would just, why not, let's just embrace the fame and, you know... Let's play the Irene Cara version of the title song from that great 80s movie that started it all. This is The Casting Couch. You thought I was going to say something else, then I had some other witty thing to say. I don't.
Okay. You're on The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9 Fame.
You're on The Casting Couch with Kylie and Thomas on Joy 94.9. And that was St. Elmo's Fire. John Parr. I actually never knew who sang that song, but that film from the 80s is a fantastic film. The Brat Packers all together having steamy sex and hanging out at the club. Oh, I just wanted to be them so badly.
It sort of defined a style of filmmaking, didn't it? That kind of ensemble friends hanging out doing stuff.
Yeah.
It was like an adult's breakfast club.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wasn't quite an adult yet. I so badly wanted to wear like those string of pearls and look super cool.
Hey, we received a text message from James, who has been out all day, just tuned into Joy, and he said, oh, I need my joy.
Oh, yes.
He saw Accidents Happen this week and loved it from the sounds of things. He's raving about the cast, the screenplay, the art direction, and he wants to know, have we covered it yet? Well, the good news, James, is no, we are in fact interviewing the writer, Brian Carby, after the news in the next hour. So keep listening. We will be talking to the writer. And if you want to head over to my website, which is blog.cinemaautopsy.com, you will find an interview that I did with Gina Davis up on that
as well. So Thomas actually met with Gina Davis and touched her in the most appropriate way, I might just say.
We shook hands. Yeah.
That's very appropriate.
Yeah.
And you had a great interview with her, and apparently she was delighted because you had asked her some questions she'd never been asked before.
Well, shucks, thank you for bringing that up. Yes, but she did. We had a really nice interview. It was
That's
lovely.
Fantastic.
Yeah, very gracious, generous, gorgeous woman.
As if I didn't love her enough already, and now even more.
But I'm going to talk about another Australian film now, because Accidents Happen actually is an Australian film. I'm going to talk about a film called Beneath Hill 60. Now, this is going to evoke for a lot of people, I think, memories of stuff like Gallipoli and even Breaking Morant. These are films that were very much made to assert Australia's cultural identity. War films that depicted the Australian soldier as, you know, heroic, anti-authoritarian and noble, who gets somewhat shafted by incompetent English command. And Beneath Hill 60 has that vibe, it has that spirit. But it also tells a really interesting part of Australian military history, which I don't think anybody has been aware of before. And that is that in World War II, 4,500 civilian miners were recruited to form the Australian Tunnelling Company. They were given 2 weeks military combat and then sent to the Western Front to basically tunnel under the trenches, get up, you know, behind underneath the Germans and blow them up from beneath.
And is this because they had mining experience and they knew how to tunnel? Is that why they were recruited?
Yep, because they were miners, that they knew how to work. They knew how to work quietly. They knew how to work quickly and economically. And they were given this limited military training and sent out to tunnel around and blow each other up.
So it makes me beg the question that I'm assuming then in this story that because they had so little military training, some of them got embroiled in things that maybe were beyond their skill level in that. Is that the case, yeah, or does it not really explore that?
The impression I always get from World War One films and what I've read is that everybody who went there had no idea how horrific it was going to be. So I think there's a very fast learning curve. And this film certainly does portray the fact that they're all quite tough, reliable, decent guys, but they're in a pretty extreme situation, to the extent that when they're actually underground in the tunnels, it's almost comforting. And the lead character, a guy called Captain Oliver Woodward, who is a real was a real person, and a lot of this film is based on his diaries. He's played by Brendan Cowell.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Sensational Australian performer who is going to really go places.
Well, he's got another film coming out, next week?
Yes, he's in the Peter Hellier film.
I love you too.
And Noise was a big success for him as well. We first sort of see him in the underground tunnels, and he's actually lost because he's just arrived and he's trying to find his company. And they just do this thing with the sound in this film where it's a constant muted sensation of the explosions and the gunfire. So you always have this incredible sense of them being really far below the ground. And as they get further to the surface, the sound intensifies. And there's this great scene where you first see him go out into the trenches, and it's hell. And they do an incredibly good job in this film creating that sensation of the trenches as being nightmarish and people getting blown to bits and just the chaos and the carnage. So it's actually quite nice when they're underground. Mm. This was all shot in northern Queensland as well.
I was just going to say, and it's Australian production, isn't it?
Yeah. Toowoomba, I think.
Wow.
Townsville.
Right.
They shot it in up and around Townsville. There's a lot of cliches in this film that are executed well.
Mm.
I mean, you do have your fairly stock bunch of characters, your good bloke commander. Officers are all a bit stuffy and clueless, and they insist on protocol over common sense that results sometimes in death. You've got your naive young soldier, and there's, you know, a couple of tough guys who turn out to be good blokes after all.
You sound a bit Benny Hill there. But it wouldn't be a war film. I know I bang on about genre and my expectations for what romantic comedies are and what dramas are and what war films are.
You've got to have these types.
You have to have them.
And that's what I'm getting at, that they're these stock characters there, but they worked well. And the director, Jeremy Hartley Sims, also known as Jeremy Sims when he's acting, but he's thrown to Hartley in for his direction work because there's another actor in America with his name, so that's why he's doing that. Look, he works it well, and the cast work really nicely together, so it does rise above any aspects that could be regarded as stereotypical.
This is his second film, is it?
Yeah,
Last Train to Frio was
the one.
Yeah, which I think is a great practice film for a film like this, which involves a lot more kind of level of.
It's a much bigger production, sure. And the camaraderie between the men is really great. We get a German perspective that comes in about halfway through the film, where we see some of the German officers who are basically doing the same sort of things, trying to counter the Australians.
Did they hire miners?
And I don't know the full German story, but you do get this impression that the Germans are average guys as well who are having to deal with idiot commanders.
Mm.
The major, major letdown in this film is it does flashback sequence to Woodward in Australia before he joined the company, and he's sort of romancing of the 16-year-old sister of an old friend of his, and it's just really kind of clunky.
You don't really need it, maybe.
Yeah, I can. They're trying to do a contrast. They're trying to humanize him and give the audience a reason for why he's wants to get out alive. You know, it's trying to help us
care
about him. But it's really kind of 1980s telly movie. The film's got a bad score, actually. The music is quite contrived and over the top, and it really stands out in these moments. It's a pity because there's so much about this film that is otherwise very strong.
How do you think it's going to compete with The Pacific on TV, which production values are just through the roof?
It can't compete with that.
Yeah.
It is a smaller film, and there are moments where you do realise it's a small production.
Yeah.
But for what it does it really well. It's a shame about the flashback sequences. This won't have the impact as something like Gallipoli, but I still think this is a really significant film that's worth seeing, especially if you're interested in Australian history. I'm going to give it 3.5 stars out of 5.
Great. Well, that's now screening at cinemas, so check it out. And meantime, we're going to continue our theme of 80s music. I just want to reassure everyone that I wasn't just listening to Rick Springfield and the Go-Go's in the 80s. I was also listening to Paul Kelly and people like Billy Bragg. Yes, I'm trying to buy back some of my street cred. So this is a fantastic Billy Bragg song from his album Talking with the Taxman About Poetry. called Help Save the Youth of America. This is The Casting Couch with Kylie and Thomas on Joy 94.9.
You're listening to The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie. Now, we are now joined on the line by Brian Carby, the writer of Accidents Happen, a new Australian film currently playing that stars Gina Davis, playing a character who is based on Brian's mother. Brian, welcome to The Casting Couch.
Hello. I know, I think she'd be very impressed that Gina was playing her.
That's really cool. I think my mother would love to have someone of that calibre play her. Now, Brian, Accidents Happen is an Australian film, but it's set in Connecticut in the 1980s. How did this project evolve the way that it did?
Well, because I'm an Australian now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that simple. I mean, it's kind of caused a bit of controversy, but, you know, it's an immigrant story to some extent and very universal in its positioning. So it... And it was a real challenge to be able to make it here. So, you know, we...
Yeah, you made it in Sydney, didn't you?
Yeah, we made it in Sydney. Yeah. I mean, at one point we thought, oh, it'd be really cool to make it there. But then, you know, after investigating just all the budget that was going to be necessary to get it on the screen and then discover that so much of the budget was going to be paid to fringe costs and travel costs and all these things that weren't actually going to put a good quality film on the screen, it got to be a real no-brainer, really, that we wanted to make it here until we had a good support group around us here and some really good creatives that Andrew and I, who's the director, had worked with prior. So we wanted to some extent, keep the team together and go on this adventure together and not kind of co-opt it out to other people far away.
Now, you mentioned it's been a bit controversial. Why is this? Has there been a sense that some people feel that we should only be making distinctively Aussie stories that...
Yeah, oddly.
There were kangaroos in there, or...
No, there's no Australian content per se, but, you know, there's human content, and it's kind of my feeling. I think, I mean, ultimately it was funded, so it was the funding body's feeling as well, with the FFC, that, you know, the Australian film industry is mature enough now to branch out and to and really pursue good stories as opposed to just... At all costs, it has to be the Australian voice.
Yeah, well, we saw that with Bright Star and Disgrace. They were both Australian films set in other countries and time periods even, and people didn't seem to get as fussed. I think we should be mature enough to be able to tell universal stories and have Australian talent working on them.
Well, yeah, it's better than, you know, having an Australian story filmed overseas using foreign crew. You know, so that the job stayed here, the people got the training here, young actors got a break here. I think it was a bit of a win-win.
Now, how autobiographical is this film?
Not terribly, in that, you know, the central relationship between the mother and Billy, Gloria and Billy, is, to some extent, the relationship I had with my mother. Quite a lively one.
I
mean, I wrote this to pay tribute to her because I think my mother was incredible and kind of made me who I am today. And I love her use of language. I love the drama of her. You know, she's a gay man's mum. Of course she was going to have a gay son, that woman.
I mean, all those... all the pithy sayings she has and all of the ways that she turns a phrase on its head, that is the fantastic use of language in this film was so, and obviously Gina's delivery of that. So are all of those directly from your mother's mouth, or did you take some liberties?
Others have been devised to suit situations here in the flavor of her. It had its original screening in New York at Tribeca like a year ago, and my family was there, and my brothers, who were hysterical. They go, oh my God, that's Mom.
So it was a positive reaction then.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, this has taken a long time to go from script to screen, because didn't it originally start as a short film, and then did you write a novel, and then it turned into a feature script?
Well, it even started much earlier than that. It started as a stage show called In Search of Mike, where I played the mother role and the Billy role, flip-flopping back and forth, and there was choreography involved. I'm a dancer and a choreographer.
Yep.
That's been my training.
I'm visualizing it now.
And then it was a stand-up show for a little while. I mined the material, and then it became I totally reworked it. It was a duet for a while, and then it became a short film.
Wow.
And it was at a performance of the stage show that the director saw it, and we first met, and he got excited about the prospect of making a film around that, and we did it. It was incredibly successful. And it still can be seen online. Accidents Happen. In Search of Mike on... Just look up... Just Google that.
Google. Yeah. Is it on YouTube?
You can just look at it. It won't cost you anything.
Is it on YouTube?
Don't know. I know it's Andrew Lancaster's MySpace.
All right. We'll look it up and we'll link to it on our Facebook page.
Right.
Yep. Now, so you originally played the Gloria character, your mum.
And in then, the short film, I was the mother.
And now you've got Gina Davis playing this role. Did you
showed her the short film. It kind of scared her a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel it was necessary to try to tell Gina how to play a middle-aged woman, or do you think
no,
she kind of had it down?
Absolutely not. No. But it was amazing. When we first met, we talked about both our mothers for, hours, and she just took pages and pages of notes. It was the trippiest thing on earth. I was like, my God. She was writing down everything I said.
Wonderful. Well, Brian, we want to keep chatting. There's a lot more about the film we would still like to talk to you about, but we're just going to pause to play another song from the film. Carly, what are we going to listen to?
We're actually going to listen to Walking on a Dream, which sounds like it should be from the 80s, but it's not. It's a current release by a fantastic band called Empire and the Sun. So this is The Casting Couch with Thomas and Carly on Joy 94.9.
We're back in a moment to continue talking to Brian Carby, the writer of Accidents Happen. Empire of the Sun with Walking on a Dream from the soundtrack to Accidents Happen. Now we're speaking to Brian Carby, who is the writer of Accidents Happen. Now, Brian, one thing in this film is the lead character, Billy, who you said is sort of loosely based on yourself.
Yeah.
He and a character called Doug form this very close and intense friendship, which feels like it's going to be more.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't quite become more in the film. I was wondering, am I reading the right sort of things into this film?
Oh, yeah, I mean, the gay content is... in a way, homeopathic. there was, at one point, its development, quite a lot of sexual activity that went on. And as we refined the story, we discovered it's much more about that central relationship. But I still love the idea that, quite universally, boys of that age, of 13 to 15, 16, in that age, they form really intense bonds, whether they're sexual or not. And to some extent, even when they're not sexual, they're quite romantic. Because it's that time of age where boys or girls, they start to make decisions about themselves and who they are, and they start to challenge authority and challenge their boundaries a bit. And your best friend becomes the person who understands you most.
Yeah.
And you think is going to be your best friend forever.
Mm.
And it's a love relationship.
Yeah. Well, because at that age, just finding someone who gets you is enormously important. Mm. Yeah.
And Billy clearly is not interested in the sister. She's a bit of a beard just to get into the house, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's some awkward moments between the two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're both trying to break out, and they don't really know how to act up. They're both kind of testing these boundaries, but really don't quite know how to step forward. But it's the relationship between Billy and Doug that really has the currency there. And to some extent, what Billy chooses to give up in order to just keep his family safe. And I wanted to suggest there was more there so that it, at this point in his life, it's quite a sacrifice he's making.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think ultimately, like in the very... and epilogue, and the voiceover said that Gloria hugs Doug at the funeral, and there's a sense that maybe at the conclusion of the film that relationship then has been normalized. It's just a brief moment, but that the seeds are set for Billy, I think, and that process of coming out is a very long one. And considering the tragedy he's been through in his family, it's going to be even longer for him. But he's now on the right road because he's feeling things. Because he can't really have a love relationship until, you know, his heart's opened. And that's what happens right at the end of the film.
Now, a big part of this film is that it's a family who are really beset by tragedy. And a lot of, you know, horrible things happen to them, and some of it's really darkly funny, especially the opening sequence. It's just so wrong in such a funny way. Where did that come from? Is this based on anything that you have experienced?
No, just I think the humour growing up in my household and the nature of it, and I like dark humour. And I also think, you know, around tragedies and funerals that, you know, it's only a matter of hours before there was, like, Princess Di jokes. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the human nature. You need to insulate yourself from the harsher aspects of the world by finding that dark spark that's going to make you laugh or just give you a little bit of, oh, I can cope with this because I can laugh.
Mm.
And so that's what I was trying to do here, find an avenue in. And I think people, truly resilient, interesting, brave people, as these characters are, you know, some of them, Gloria and Billy, have really developed a very cynical dark humor, and Gloria uses it as a weapon, but also as a shield so that she can kind of just stay safe.
Sure. When I saw this, I sort of thought of describing it as David Sedaris meets Blue Velvet. Because, you know, Sedaris has that really wicked sense of humor, and he often...
I like that.
Yeah, how's that?
You can steal that.
Well, just going on to that Blue Velvet thing, that opening sequence I thought was really evocative of the opening of Blue Velvet. And the whole look of this film reminded me of a lot of those very suburban gothic films, such as American Beauty and Donnie Darko.
Mm-hmm.
Were these clear influences for you and Andrew, director Andrew Lancaster?
Absolutely. And Ice Storm was another one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And that whole weird normalness of suburbia that just creates such interesting people if you peel everything back. And, and we were looking at Jeffrey Crudson photographs as well, who does lots of suburban landscapes but highly theatricalized. He brings in lighting and there's always some kind of dramatic element in it. And so that was, in terms of our design, really working off his photographs and these films that we really love.
Mm-hmm.
The ones you mentioned particularly.
Did you guys have anything to do with the film Beautiful, which came out last year?
No, but Sebastian Gregory.
Because you have the same lead actor.
Yeah.
And just a very similar production design and look.
No, I don't think any of our crew were... I think Sebastian was the only common denominator between those two films.
It's just one of those weird things where you get sort of two films with a similar vibe that come out at the same time. Was this a cathartic project for you? Because you've spoken about this film being a stage show and a short film and...
then it was a novel.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get published in between.
Right.
Well, it was to an extent because my mother died in 2000. And she died just 10 days before we had the very first screening of the short film. So she never saw it.
Yeah.
And in a way, that short film is quite harsh because the stage show had all this choreography, which was really where the humanity and the kind of gentleness of the relationship was played out, and the textural elements were quite harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And so we eliminated the movement aspects, and so the script was really pretty full-on. Funny, but full-on. And I didn't feel really good about that, so I thought he needed to set the record straight. And so I wrote the book, and then Andrew read it and optioned it,
And
the rest is history. Here it is on the big screen.
Yeah, so now I think it's really time to put that story to bed now and move on to something else.
Well, look, Brian, I think you've done it justice, as have, you know, your actors and director, Andrew Lancaster. Thank you so much for speaking us today on the Casting Couch here in Joy 94.9.
Thank you.
Cheers. We've been speaking to Brian Carby, the writer of Accidents Happen.
And continuing with our 80s theme of music, and this film, Accidents Happen, is set in the 80s, I've just decided to go with Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. It just felt appropriate. This is The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9. This The Casting Couch with Kylie and Thomas on Joy 94.9. And that was Get Into the Groove, Into the Groove by Madonna. It's our 80s theme that we're exploring today. And that was from Desperately Seeking Susan, a great 80s film. For those in the know, the Festival of German Film started on Wednesday. It is actually screening in every major city around the country. So for those of our listeners who are listening online at joy.org.au, welcome and check out, you can check out the festival program at the Goethe Institute. It's actually goethe.de/Australia. That's where you can just Google.
We'll put it up on our Facebook page.
We'll put it up on our Facebook page. And so there have been some special guests who are over for the festival, one of whom is Erica Fisher. She is actually the author of more than 12 books, and among them is Ami and Jaguar, the real-life story of two women in war-troubled Germany. It was first published in 1994, and it has been a huge success. Since then, it's been translated into over 20 languages, and in 1998, it was made into a major film, which is actually going to be screening several times during the festival. Erica Fisher, she currently lives in Berlin and is a freelance author, interpreter and journalist, and she joins us on the line now. Hi, Erica.
Hello.
Now, you've just literally got off a plane.
Right, I've been in Melbourne and now I'm back in Sydney.
So, were you here last night in Melbourne for when your film screened in the festival?
Yes.
And what was that experience like, seeing it with an Australian audience?
It was interesting for me to see it because I hadn't seen it for many, many years, to see it again. And the Australian audience was very pleasant, so a few people left and the others stayed and virtually sort of were hanging on my lips. But unfortunately, we didn't have enough time to really have a lengthy conversation because there's so much to be said about this story, which is an incredible story.
It is an amazing story. And it's actually based on real life experiences.
Absolutely.
When you were, I mean, what brought you to first hear about the story, and how did you come to meet Elizabeth Wurst, who is like the real life Lily in the story?
Right. Well, I spoke to her the first time in 1991. That's ages ago. when the book was published, I never would have thought that in 2010 I would be still talking about it. And the story was offered to me by my publisher. My publisher asked me whether I wanted to write it, and it was offered to my publisher by a friend of Lily Wurst, an American friend, who had the idea that the story could be a great success, yeah, and he was quite right so. Although he thought it would be a second Anne Frank, which it hadn't become, but still, I'm quite satisfied with the success.
Well, certainly in the lesbian community, it has an incredible ongoing success, and it is still one of the most popular films, and I'm sure novel as well for the lesbian audience.
Yeah, well, there are not so many lesbian stories about this particular period in time in Germany. I think that's the extraordinary thing about the story, that it happened between a, under inverted commas, Aryan woman and a Nazi woman in the 40s, yes, where the Jews actually weren't supposed to be alive anymore. And also that it is a true story, that there are lots and lots of documents, that there are beautiful poems and love letters the women wrote to each other, and beautiful photographs. So I think part of the success of the book is that the photographs are so intriguing. These two women were so attractive. So it's easy for young women today to identify with these two women. And by identifying with these two women, understand a bit what this terrible time was like.
Well, I think, I'm not sure if this is correct, but it seems like they use the real life photos in the film as well, and they are so poignant and very moving. And I think you've touched on it a little bit here, but maybe we should talk about this a little bit more. It is amazing that this story still has relevance 15 years after you first published it, but it's been over 50 years since the events actually took place. Why do you feel this story still resonates so strongly?
Well, it, as I said, there are very few or no lesbian stories in this period. And then, well, I don't know. One never can learn enough about the Holocaust and about what happened in that time. And every new generation has to start learning again.
Yes.
And, well, love stories are always relevant. We read love stories that are much older than Aimé and Jaguar. Yeah, I think it will go on being relevant.
Well, I hope so. I think so too. Yeah, I actually I watched the film again this week, and I hadn't seen it since it was first released, and it did really feel to me like that story is still so heartfelt and still is so important to be told.
Sorry, I didn't understand you.
It still feels to me that when I watched the film again, I hadn't seen it for quite some time, that it is still an important story to be told.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe today, if the movie had been made today, it would be slightly different.
Mm.
But for the time when it was done, it's okay. You know, I'm not 100% happy with the movie, of course, as an author. But I think at the time, German movies were just about to raise their heads, because after the end of the war, everything was destroyed. And in the meantime, the German film has become really a very good product.
I mean, this program of the Festival of German Films just goes to show how incredibly strong the German cinema is.
The movie is, of course, plays with emotions, and they highlight scenes that in my book were only two lines. Yes. So I have a rather subdued style, because I felt that the events are so strong, and what the women had to tell each other was so strong that it wasn't necessary to over-emotionalize. So the emotions are created in the reader, and all I needed to do was write a decent book and include all the material that I could possibly find.
I mean, it is often a thing that when authors have their work translated to the screen, because it is such a different medium, that it can be a very very challenging experience.
exactly. But I mean, I have been working in the media long enough to know that a film is a film and a book is a book.
Absolutely.
So, but of course, a lot of information about Felice Schragenheim, that is the Jewish girl's past, about her parents, grandparents, how she grew up in this is not included in the movie, of course. This cannot be. So the movie concentrates on the love story, but it does highlight some political aspects, and it does show the danger in which Jews in hiding were during this period of time. Yeah?
Mm.
Because Felice, who called herself Jaguar, was in hiding in Berlin, and her life every single day was in danger. So this love with Lili Wurst, whom she called Aimé, helped her to survive 16 months. Yes, and then unfortunately it ended badly.
It is it's an incredible story, and I would encourage all of our listeners to go back to the book, which is based on these diaries and interviews that you conducted yourself, to really get more of a sense. If you've loved the film, I would certainly encourage you to find out more and read the novel, which is still available. You know, it's been so fantastic to speak with you about this incredibly important work, and I speak for myself that I know that when I saw the film when it was first released, it really was something like I'd never seen before, because it's a big period piece, it's a big budget film, and it just shows a whole different side to a story that we haven't seen before. So I wanted to thank you so much for coming on our show, Erica.
Okay,
and
thank you.
I wish you all the best. You are actually up in Sydney, for those of our online listeners who will be in Sydney, and you'll be attending the screenings there on Sunday and Monday.
On Sunday and on Monday, yes.
And then if you would like to catch the film on the big screen back here in Melbourne, it will actually be screening again on Sunday the 2nd of May. I'd encourage you to check out the fantastic program of the Festival of German Films. Go online, Google it, and we'll also have a link on our Facebook site.
And
Oh, yes.
Also important to say is that the book is still available in English.
Yes. In English. You can Google that as well.
Yes.
And it's been fantastic speaking to you, Erica. This has been The Casting Couch with Kylie and Thomas on Joy 94.1. That's a song you haven't heard for a while, I'm imagining. It's in a big country by the band Big Country from the 80s. We are celebrating all things Hot Tub Time Machine on The Casting Couch with Kylie and Thomas, Joy 94.9. It's been a bit of an 80s revival show, hasn't it, Thomas?
It's been great fun. Great fun.
Oh, I'm actually,
you know what I like about 80s music is it was an era where you had that, there was the big pop hits and they were what they were.
Yes.
And then you had a real alternative scene, which was doing lots of really interesting things as well.
Yes.
They were two definitely different scenes, both doing great things, and I loved it.
Yeah, no, we grew up in the 80s. We absolutely love it. We had a packed show, and we've also had heaps of people SMSing in and sending us emails.
Shall I read out this final SMS that I got on our main SMS address? This is from Adam. We were talking about Gina Davis, so I think Adam got excited by that, as of course you would, and said, "Go for the long kiss, good night."
That is a kick-ass film.
It was a great
action film.
Yeah, apparently there was talk of doing a sequel, but the film didn't perform that well, so it never happened.
She's so good in that.
At the Q&A at Cinema Nova I did with Gina Davis, I'll just pick that up. She did actually acknowledge that she had a ball during that film. It was good fun.
It looks like she really did.
She also mentioned that every now and then she gets asked, will there be a sequel to Thelma and Louise?
Oh, God, another seminal. I don't think you can touch that.
Think about that. A sequel to Thelma and Louise.
Oh, the car went down. Oops, spoiler. The car went into it, but then maybe it came back up again.
A zombie film. I don't know. Anyway, Adam
zombie
also
Thelma and Louise.
That's also her favourite film of all time, she said.
Oh, I love that
gorgeous
film.
If you check out cinemaautopsy.com, you can hear the interview I did with her where she talks about it. I'm shameless. Adam also says that the best action film of all time, though, is Nikita by Luc Besson.
You've got to have the Luc Besson version.
Yeah.
That is an amazing film. Don't go for the American remake.
Which was what was that called? Assassins or The Assassin?
Something like that. Mm. But that is a fantastic.
The Luc Besson Nikita is a splendid film. Now, you've got some rather fun things that have come directly onto your phone.
I also just wanted to suggest to one of our listeners, Iden, and his partner Ben, they're listening in. Hi, guys. Can you maybe send your text messages to the Joy line, not my personal phone, so I can respond to them as I get them?
Taking liberties, aren't they?
Funny enough, I don't have my phone on while I do the show, but they got a little bit cross at me because I was giving away too much of the movie in Hot Tub Time Machine, I think. So what I would say to that...
There's not a heap to give away.
Yeah, well, Iden did admit that there's not much to give away. It's not like it's a Harry Potter movie, he said. And he also said that they loved Ghost Rider and Daredevil.
Oh.
So, you know, just putting it out there. Though I would say if you want to keep the secrets of Hot Tub Time Machine, don't watch the TV commercial and certainly don't watch the trailer because that's it. That's it, people. It's a longer version of that.
We've got to get out of here, Kylie. We're going to say thank you very much to Murray for looking after the news and a massive thank you to Brian Carby, the writer of Accidents Happen.
And also, it was fantastic and a real honour to speak to Erica Fisher, who's the author of Ami and Jaguar, a lesbian classic.
Thank you to Alan, our producer and panellist, as always. And thank you to everybody who listened and took the time to get in touch with us tonight. It's been wonderful,
actually. We feel awfully popular. We feel like the cool kids in the school.
Yeah, I wish Daylight Savings ended earlier. I love it. It's been great hearing from you all. Keep listening to Joy 94.9. Things are going to start getting pumping here with A Touch of Pink by Dennis and Dick. They're in the next studio or ready to go. It's always a delight to find out what they're going to play on the show this week. I do enjoy listening to it myself.
And a final track to take us out for the 80s. Let's go with the classic Tainted Love. This has been The Casting Couch with Thomas and Kylie on Joy 94.9.
This Joycast is a free service brought to you by Joy 94.9. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.